This is the story.
Hans Christian Andersen, the ugly duckling who charmed the world. Friends, this is Ben Grauer speaking. Today we bring you the story of probably one of the unhappiest men who ever lived. A novelist whose novels collect dust on library shelves. A playwright whose plays are forgotten. A poet whose best poems turned out to be prose. A Dane who, long after his passing, is internationally remembered for what was but a byproduct of his life, fairy tales. Stories which today still bring to children of the world that which he could never achieve for himself, happiness. This is the story of a long, limp, ungainly, and awkward, an odd, sensitive, vain, pathetic, discontented genius of a man who wanted desperately to believe what he wrote of himself in his autobiography. My life is a lovely story, happy and full of incident. If when I was a boy and went forth into the world, poor and friendless, and the good fairy had met me and said, "Choose now thine own course in life, and I will guide and defend thee to its attainment," my fate could not even then have been directed more happily, more prudently, or better. The history of my life will say to the world what it says to me. There is a loving God who directs all things for the best.
Hans Christian Andersen was born ugly, friendless, and poor. He had a madman for a grandfather, a cobbler for a father who died also out of mind, and an overburdened, superstitious peasant mother. These are what he had to start with. Now we will show you how fairy tales are born. You're in a cobbler's shop in the city of Odense, 22 Danish miles from Copenhagen. Hans, 10 years old in this year, 1815, sits enchanted on the shoe bench as his father tells him a story.
And after a time, the Sultan died. And Aladdin sat on the royal throne and ruled and administered justice. All the people loved him. He lived with his wife until, as it says in the Arabian Nights, they were visited by the terminator of delights and the separator of companions.
It was wonderful, Father. Is it a true story?
Do you believe it was, my son?
Oh, yes.
Then it is a true story. For everything is but what we believe it is.
I wish we had books, Father. Mountains of books. So I could know all the stories in them.
I too, Hans. But I, whose mind was full of intelligence, was apprenticed to a shoemaker. Look at me. Beware, my son. Do not die a craftsman. And the other is the path upon which you should have gone.
He lived for me, my father. For conversation with his equals was denied him. And there was nothing else to live for.
Hans Christian, take this soup to thy grandfather.
Oh, but, Mama, I fear grandfather. Please, Mama.
Hans Christian.
He cuts strange figures out of wood. I've seen them. Men with beasts' heads and beasts with wings.
Oh, 'tis only that he is not of this world, my son. He will not harm you.
This morning I heard the boys in the street shouting after him. I hid myself behind a flight of steps in terror, for I knew I was of his flesh and blood.
For shame, Hans, for shame.
I was very much afraid of my weak-minded grandfather.
Today, Hans, we must help the manor gather the harvest.
Oh, will I go into the fields, Mother? Into the fields?
Yes, but you must be careful of that bailiff. Oh, he's a rude, savage man. Should he come towards us, we must run, you hear?
I'll run, Mother. I'll run like a fox.
We had not been working long when we saw the bailiff coming with a huge whip in his hand. My mother and all the others ran away. I had wooden shoes on my feet, and in my haste, I lost these. The thorns pricked me, so I could not run. The man came up and lifted his whip to strike me when I looked up at him and cried,
"How dare you strike me when God can see it?"
The strong, stern man looked at me and at once became mild. He patted me on the cheek, asked me my name, and gave me money. When I brought this to my mother and showed it to her,
The bailiff gave it to me.
My mother looked full of wonder at the money and at me and said to the others,
"He is a strange one, my Hans Christian. Everybody's kind to him. This bad fellow even has given him money."
And it was so.
Look what winter has sent us.
I see nothing, Father. Only a frozen window pane.
Alas, lad, you must learn to see what others cannot see. Now look, I scratch on the frosted pane with my fingernail, and it is...
a maiden. An ice maiden.
Yes, she has come to fetch me. She has come to fetch me.
The ice maiden operated so powerfully on me that when it grew dark, I scarcely dared go out of the house.
Hans Christian.
Yes, Mama, what is it?
Thy father is dying. Hurry, my son.
To the physician, Mama?
No, no, to the wise woman who lives across the river. Hurry, hurry.
I went to her full of fright, the one we children call the witch. She questioned me, and then...
Now I will measure thy arm with a woolen thread. There, 'tis done. Now I shall make the signs. And last I lay the green twig upon thy breast.
But my father...
Silence. This twig is of the same kind of tree upon which thy savior was crucified.
Will it save my father?
Go now by the river towards thy home. If thy father will die this evening, thou wilt meet his ghost. Hurry, hurry.
Imagine my anxiety and distress. I, who was so full of superstition, whose imagination was so eagerly excited. When I told it all to my mother, she asked...
And thou hast not met anything, hast thou?
No, Mama. I did not meet anything.
My father died the third day after that. Since his corpse lay on the bed, I therefore slept with my mother. The whole night through, a cricket chirped. And finally, my mother addressed it.
He is dead. Thou needst not call him. The ice maiden hath fetched him.
I understood what she meant. After my father's death, I was left entirely to myself. My mother went out washing. I very seldom played with other boys. I remained sitting within doors, playing with a little theater my father had made for me, making doll's clothes and reading plays. And I heard for the first time the word poet spoken. I learned that it was something glorious, something fortunate to be a poet. Here, too, for the first time, I read Shakespeare, waited for the ghost in Hamlet, heard the witches in Macbeth.
Double, double, toil and trouble. Fire burn and cauldron bubble. Scale of dragon, tooth of wolf, witches...
Inspired, I wrote my first piece. But I was laughed and hooted at for my stories by the other children. One day I was pursued by a wild crowd of them who shouted at me derisively, "There goes the playwriter!" I hid myself at home in a corner and wept and prayed to God. I grew rapidly, and with every inch, my ambition grew a millionfold. My mother resolved to apprentice me to a tailor.
No, Mama, please, I beg you.
But the tailor's a good trade, my son. A tailor never wants for food.
No, Mama, no, no, please.
But what else is there for thee?
Copenhagen.
Copenhagen?
The greatest city in the world, Mama. I must see it. I must.
But what wilt thou do there, my son?
I will become famous.
Famous? Oh, thou a cobbler's son?
People have, Mama. I myself read of it in books. First, you must suffer a great deal, Mama. Then you become famous.
But my child, Copenhagen.
I prayed. I wept. Until at last my mother sought the counsel of the wise woman, the witch who lived across the river.
Mother of Hans Christian Andersen, this the coffee grounds and the cards say to thee.
Please.
Thy son will become a great man. And in honor of him, this city of Offensa will one day be illuminated.
And so my mother packed my clothes in a small bundle and accompanied me to the city gate. She fell upon my neck and wept without being able to speak a word. I myself was deeply affected. And thus we parted. I saw her for the last time. My poor, illiterate, loving mother, when I turned my eyes, a child of 14, toward Copenhagen. There, then, is the childhood that molded this man, told in the words of Hans Christian Andersen himself. A childhood full of poverty and superstition, of ghosts and witches. A childhood as fantastic as the tales which later sprang from it. And now let us pick up his story for you. Let us compress in a few sentences the cold and hunger, the privations of the following years. Years in which he tried to be a singer, an actor, a dancer, a scholar, and failed in all. Yet somehow pressed on because he honestly believed.
First, you must suffer a great deal, Mama. Then you become famous.
Now he is at school under a patron's shelter. Then the government's. Don't ask how he managed it. He had a way about him, he did. An innocent pushiness, a childishness that melted all who fell under his spell. For do you not recall?
He is a strange one, my Hans Christian. Everybody is kind to him.
He publishes his first book, a remarkable piece of imitation and parody. He publishes a volume of sentimental, mawkish poems, then weeps and storms at his critics. More books, then plays. More books and more plays until, almost miraculously, as is his own fairy tales, Hans Christian Andersen is crowned with success. Success which from the time he left Odense, he had in his innocence expected would follow his suffering as day follows night. And so now, we give you Hans Christian Andersen, the toast of Copenhagen, the rage of Sweden, the consort of counts, dukes, and kings, acclaimed, honored, famous enough to be caricatured, decorated, cheered in his travels, received with tears in Germany, flowers in Italy, wine in France, even open arms in England. The cobbler's son, Hans Christian Andersen.
Father in heaven, what dost thou give to me?
Hans Christian Andersen, whose grandfather was a madman.
I live in everlasting fear that the same madness will overtake me.
Who wept through his childhood.
To this day, the least thing rejoices my soul, but let the wind blow it all sharply and my eyes fill with tears.
Who could not bear criticism.
My critics wish only to trample me in the dust. Yet I shall live. Live when they are only dead names, all of them. I shall be a poet in whom Denmark will feel honored. They shall bow to me like the sun and the moon in Joseph's dream.
Who doubted his own fame even when it came.
Would they believe it in Odense when I was born? Not they. They saw me without wings, wearing wooden shoes and going with the milk pail to the village.
Yes, Hans Christian Andersen, who won the whole world, but could not find happiness.
Why am I always discontent? Why can I not be joyous, gay? Why do I always look for happiness in the future? Why can I never be content with the present? The present.
He was like the fir tree in the story he wrote. One of those simple little stories for children that poured out between his poems and novels and plays. The stories he had first disdained, but which later gained him the eternal fame he thirsted for. Yes, in many ways, Hans Christian Andersen was like his very own story of the fir tree.
Deep in the distant forest, kissed by the sun and the air, grew a lovely young fir tree. The children loved it and called it the prettiest little tree in all the forest. Still, it was unhappy. Oh, how I wish I was as tall as the other trees, it complained. Then I could spread my branches every which way, and my top would look over the whole wide world. It was so unhappy the little tree did not enjoy the warm sun, the birds, or the beautiful clouds that passed above it. Two winters came and went, and the rabbits, which once jumped over the tree, now had to pass around it. Still, the fir was not satisfied. Oh, if I'd only get taller and older, nothing else matters, it sighed. When the woodcutters came in autumn and cut the tallest trees down and hauled them away, the fir tree asked the birds, "Where are they going, do you know?" "Yes," said the stork, "when I flew over some ships on my way from Egypt, they had fine masts that smelt just like fir. I'm sure they were once trees. They were very handsome and very stately." "Oh, how I wish I were tall enough to go to sea," exclaimed the fir tree. "Rejoice that you're still young," said the sunbeam. "Be happy now." But the fir tree paid no attention.
You know the rest. Know how the tree, when winter came, yearned to be taken like some of the others to be decorated at Christmas time. know how, after its wish was fulfilled, it was discarded and chopped into wood until...
As it was thrown into the fireplace, the fir tree remembered the summer day in the forest. The warm sunlight, the birds, the rosy clouds. Past. It is all past, sighed the old tree. Oh, had I been happy and enjoyed myself while I had the chance. Now it is too late.
Yes, the fir tree was a part of Hans Christian Andersen, just as was every story he ever wrote. Take The Nightingale. Andersen was madly in love with Jenny Lind, the famous Swedish singer. He protested to her that she was not receiving the honor that she deserved.
But what does it matter, Hans Christian? I'm free and content.
It matters to me when the king and his court acclaim mediocrity instead. Living music boxes who sing the same artificial tune over and over because it's the only one they know.
I'm not envious, Hans. I have no desire to bejewel myself and feather my nest in court. I couldn't stand it.
But don't you see, dearest Jenny, you are the one they should be worshipping, not those shams.
Hans, oh, Hans.
They should fall on their knees before such a voice as yours and thank Almighty God for sending them a nightingale.
A nightingale? How sweet of you to say.
You are a nightingale, you know. My nightingale. And I shall do more than just say it. You'll see.
It happened many years ago, but that's just why it's worthwhile to hear the story before it's forgotten. In China, you know, the emperor is Chinese. And so are all the people around him. The Chinese emperor had a beautiful palace surrounded by forests. Travelers the world over came to visit the emperor's palace, and when they left, they always said that though the palace was beautiful and the garden splendid, what they liked best was the nightingale. And so the emperor said,
what is this nightingale they rave about? Do I have to learn about my own nightingale from strangers?
I never heard of it, Your Majesty, replied his gentleman-in-waiting. I'm sure it has never been presented at court.
Well, bring it to the palace this very evening so that I may hear it. If it is not forthcoming, I'll have the whole court trampled upon after supper.
Frightened, the courtier searched and searched until at last he found the nightingale in the forest.
Is that it? He exclaimed, disappointed. Why, it's awfully common looking.
But when the bird sang, he cried, just like crystal bells. Tonight you will charm the emperor, for he would hear you. I'm sure you'll be a great success at court.
But I sound best among the trees, sir.
But the courtier had hurried away. That night, the palace was brightened for the occasion. When the nightingale sang, tears rolled down the emperor's cheeks.
For your reward, O nightingale, you should have my golden slipper around your neck.
Thank you, Your Highness. The tears in the eyes of my emperor is as nice a reward as I can ever wish.
The whole town talked about the marvelous bird. It had to stay in court now with 12 footmen each holding a ribbon tied around its leg. But one day, the Emperor of China received from the Emperor of Japan an artificial nightingale, exactly like the living one, only studded with diamonds, rubies, and sapphires. When the bird was wound up, it could sing one of the songs the real one could, the same one, over and over mechanically, and wag its tail, too. How wonderful, everyone cried, and they all forgot about the live nightingale who flew back into the wood. So the artificial bird took its place on a silken cushion next to the emperor's bed. One evening, something gave way inside the bird, and all of a sudden, all the wheels and the music stopped. The emperor sent for his private physicians, but they were helpless. Even the watchmaker could not make it the same again. Soon after, the emperor lay pale and still. Death came to claim him. Only music could frighten death away. The emperor cried for help to his golden bird.
Music, sing, sing. I have given you precious stones, even hung my golden slipper about your neck. Sing, I tell you, sing.
But the artificial bird stood silent. Suddenly there at the window there was a burst of lovely song. It was the living nightingale. It had come back to help its emperor. Even death listened enchanted and promised to go away if only the nightingale would sing again. After death had departed, the emperor cried,
oh, thanks, thanks, you heavenly little bird. I have banished you from my kingdom, yet you have charmed death away from my heart. How can I ever repay thee?
Your tears were once enough. They are still.
I will break the artificial bird into 1,000 pieces.
No. No, don't do that. It did the best it could. Keep it. Only, I cannot build my nest and live in this palace. I must be free and live in the woods. But I will come whenever you like and sing to you to comfort you.
Then the nightingale sang again. And the emperor fell into a sweet, happy sleep, from which he awoke fresh and strong.
Anderson's Story of the Nightingale and Jenny Lind, who came to be called the Swedish Nightingale, went on to fame together. But Anderson's affection was not fated to end like his story so happily. To the end of their acquaintance, Jenny Lind called him merely brother. And now to the remote recesses of the world, Hans Christian Andersen's tales, translated even into the Hindustani and Eskimo, spread to become part of the childhood of a generation. One after another, they forced themselves out of his mind so fast they fairly danced on the paper. To him, as to a child, a doll was as much alive as a cat, a broom as animate as a bird. But perhaps no tale he wrote was so thoroughly a veiled autobiography than his most famous of all, The Ugly Duckling. He was the guest of the Queen when the story occurred to him. He stood looking out. What a contrast with the past. When I was poor, miserable, misunderstood. And now, princes and nobles so kind to me. I am like one of the wild ducks I saw at the hunt yesterday, suddenly turned into a swan. But how can a duck become a swan? Why, yes, I see it now. I've always been a swan. If they could have only recognized it when I seemed like an ugly duckling. What a theme for a fairy tale. Who is it who does not know the story of the ugly duckling? Of the duck who hatched a strange bird, ungainly and queer, who only out of pity was permitted to remain. Pushed about and bitten, made fun of, he became the butt of the whole duckyard. Despairing of his frightful ugliness, he determines to kill himself. But here let Anderson finish his own story.
I will fly away to them, to the royal birds, the swan, said the ugly duckling. They will beat me because I, who am so ugly, dare come near them. But it is all the same. Better to be killed by them than to be pursued by ducks, beaten by fowls. And so it flew out into the water and swam toward the beautiful swan. Kill me, said the poor creature, and bent its head down upon the water, expecting nothing but death. But what was this that it saw in the clear water? It beheld its own image. And lo, it was no longer a clumsy, dark gray bird, ugly and hateful to look at, but a swan. It matters nothing if one is born in a duckyard, if one is only lain in a swan's egg.
Thus, for Hans Christian Andersen, the ugly duckling who charmed the world, whose stories lie in every American home, a source of everlasting pleasure to our children, and an immeasurable part of the childhood heritage of all of us. Well, may we say today, thank you, Denmark.
This is the United States Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education.
My name is Freedom. I'm the guts of man. I command man. My command today is unite. Unite for a people's victory. Unite in brotherhood and win the peace. Today you have a new chance. A new chance for greater freedom from want and fear than man has ever known. The chance is yours. The choice is yours. Your choice, along with the peoples of the world, through your United Nations organization. Were you one of the scoffers, the doubters of the world, wondering if they would succeed in San Francisco on June 26, 1945? Then, delegates representing most of the peoples of the world came to a circular table and with quiet dignity signed their names to the Charter of the United Nations. But while the roll of the nations was being called, before the ink was dry on the charter, were you saying...
Hey, they'll never succeed. They can't get together. We're all too different.
We had 25 years to win the peace before, and we didn't do it.
That's right, and this time there'll be no different.
Or were you among the peoples of the world who had faith? The people who said...
Why not? Why couldn't it be done? What about the Magna Carta, the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights? What about man fighting tyranny all through his struggle to walk and act like a human being, a free man? We didn't attain them by accident.
The delegates of 50 nations representing 9/10 of the world asked themselves, why not? Why not? Was that too much to ask? Then they came up with the answer on June 26, 1945. They signed the United Nations Charter. You heard the news and you wondered.
Hey, maybe it will work after all. Maybe they've learned something this time. Maybe it won't happen again. Maybe we've learned something we didn't know before.
Some of you prayed.
Our Father, God of all mankind, sit at the treaty tables today. Guide the thoughts and will of men into expected straits. Give them the courage of compromise and the kindness of tolerance. Give them the knowledge.
You heard the voices over the radio.
Never before in history have the peoples of the world been so resolute in their determination to crown past failures with future success. And never before has an organization for peace had within its ranks all the major powers of the world. In this fact alone, there is reason for sober optimism.
The signatories knew the eyes of the world had been on them. They knew how much was expected of them, but they were confident. Why? Because they'd been able to reconcile many of their disagreements. They weren't telling us everything was perfect. They'd disagreed over many things, but they'd gotten along. They'd made progress. That was the big thing. The thing that made us say...
Maybe they've done it this time.
They sound like human beings to me.
It isn't what they've done there at the conference. It's what they've learned there. That's important. They learned that they could get together and talk things over. Despite divergent viewpoints, they could get together on things they wanted. And they all want peace. Peace and security from war.
We the peoples of the world, we the peoples of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind, and to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women and of nations large and small.
Those are the words of the preamble of the United Nations Charter. They form a road wide enough for all humanity to travel. It's the only road. It encircles the entire globe and makes the world one. That road leads us into tomorrow. Where will you be tomorrow? That's up to you. You'll be living in a world of greater prosperity, stability, and justice. Or you won't be around at all. Support your United Nations. The United Nations is your first line of defense against insecurity and war. I, Freedom, beg of you to support the United Nations for a lasting peace and security for all of us. We, the peoples of the world.
This is the United States Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education.